Ahoy, mateys. Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call.
That's
for
games. That's not what we're doing today.
Oh, snap. Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the AnimeBuoy.org Anime Fan Podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for anime recommendations, news bits, and discussion that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is August 16th, 2015, and this is Episode 1, The Films of Satoshi Kon, and an introduction of sorts. Welcome, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to the maiden voyage of our new podcast, where we plan to talk about anime and hope to open your eyes to some classics that you might have missed and shine a light on shows that are currently running, but maybe aren't getting as much love as maybe they should be. This week, we're introducing ourselves to you lovely folks and recommending some of our favorites, underappreciated or otherwise, so that y'all might get to know us a little bit better. And then we're going to commemorate the 5th anniversary of Satoshi Kon's passing by talking a little bit about his film works. So buckle in and get ready for that. But first, we have a little bit of news for you.
We do?
Actually, I suppose we don't. This week, we are not really going to focus on any news. We want to sort of get to this introduction, let you know sort of who we are and what we hope to achieve here on this show, and, you know, sort of why we're doing it, and really then get down to talking about my favorite all-time Japanese filmmaker, with, of course, all apologies to Akira Kurosawa. Slaggy, why don't you start? Let's get going on this introduction. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and how you came into the anime fandom?
My name is First Mate Slagkick. I am from the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
As do I, of course, but do go on.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
Thank you. I am
a different show, man.
Yeah, I know, but still, we have to give credit where credit is due to ourselves. I am a grown man living in the San Francisco Bay Area. I am a homosexual man, and I still love anime.
That might not quite have been the kind of information I was looking for, but good to know, good to know. Slaggy, why don't you tell me, what was your first anime series that you really loved?
The first that I really loved?
And if you recall it, you're just first. What, you know, what sort of, I don't want to use adult terms in this show, but, you know, sort of what was your first introduction to the art form?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I could say that I truly loved it, because my first introduction to anime was Sailor Moon, which I'm talking about, you know, the dub that, you know, is very reviled.
Serena!
But, you know, even with its, you know, lackluster dub and, you know, being introduced to so many things since then, I think it definitely, you know, caught my interest and led me to explore other anime. You know, the first one that I really was like a super fan of was Dragon Ball Z. I mean, which probably is a very typical first anime experience.
I was going to say, I think that's probably true for a lot of people our age.
And, you know, Dragon Ball Z, again, not having necessarily the best dub either, but, you know, definitely, you know, it was offering something different than what, you know, the American animation studios were putting out. Not to crap on American animation, but, you know, I mean, I think it definitely was, you know, interested in, like, the action and, you know, the ongoing storytelling, which you didn't see a lot of back then in the American animation scene.
Excellent, excellent. And what about overall? What would anime would you call your favorite? And also, you know, if you have a specific episode that was like when it clicked for you, I'd love to hear about that too.
That's not fair.
Why isn't it fair?
No, there's just too many. Oh, there's too many to choose from. You know, I think I always have to go back to the Vision of Escaflowne, Tenku no Escaflowne, Escaflowne, whatever you want to call it. I don't know if there was necessarily a episode that it really clicked for me. I mean, I guess the first episode, honestly, but, you know, really, just, I keep going back to that because it's really a blend, and I mean, we're going to properly talk about Escaflowne at some point, but, you know, it's really a blend of all these different great anime genres that, you know, it just comes together and works super well, even though you're like, oh, a fantasy high school magical tarot card giant robot series, that shouldn't work at all, but it does, and...
When you put it like that, it sounds like Persona meets Gundam, and I'm kind of here for it.
I guess you could say that.
It's actually, yeah, I mean, I love Escaflowne. That's not really that far off the mark. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Wrap up?
Oh, no, I was just saying that, you know, I think I was pretty much sucked in right away. I can't really pinpoint a specific episode that, you know, really drew me in. I mean, the first one.
Okay. And what are your favorite genres? Because, you know, a lot of people look at anime as a genre. And one of the big things I want to fight here, and hopefully, you know, my goal is that I hope that we get some new people interested in anime that maybe aren't familiar with it. A lot of people look at anime as a genre, but that, I think, is as misguided as looking at movies as a genre. Like, no, that's
right.
That's an art form. Anime is an art form. And within it, you know, you have romantic comedies, you have sci-fi, you have action. Like, you have all of these things under anime. Anime
oh, yeah,
is
exactly.
Just one thing. And I think a lot of people really struggle with that idea. So why don't you tell me, within the world of anime, about what your favorite genres are, and you know, if you want to call out specific tropes or anything, by all means, feel free to do that as well.
Right. You know, it's interesting because when I talk about, like, books, or if I'm talking about video games even, I tend to go more for fantasy, which, you know, there's some good fantasy-inspired anime. I mean, Escaflowne, you know, definitely has a lot of elements of fantasy, but...
Record of Lodoss War.
Oh, yeah. But I think that for anime, I actually tend to go for more sci-fi. Not necessarily, like, super heavy sci-fi. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be anything like Gundam or Cowboy Bebop, which are...
I was actually going to throw out Cowboy Bebop as, like... sci-fi anime that isn't strictly just sci-fi.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, sci-fi can, I think, really play in a lot of different ways. I mean, I typically think, like, oh, sci-fi, space travel, but, you know, Trigun, things like that. I mean, like, just anything with, like, sort of, like, technological stuff in it. I mean, I think that typically is where I go to. And then the other one, obviously, being Magical Girl and just, like, anything that kind of plays with the magical girl trope as well.
Excellent. My name is Captain Spike. I like Sly
Hi,
Kick.
Captain Spike.
Hi, kids. I also live
in the... kids are listening to this?
California Bay Area. San Francisco Bay Area in California. Also homosexual man.
Hi.
My favorite anime, if I had to narrow it down, would probably come to Revolutionary Girl Utena.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. But the first anime... that really snared me. And let me step back. I used to have a good buddy. I mean, we're still good buddies. But he, when we were maybe in fifth grade, sixth grade, he had a bootleg tape of a bunch of anime that his older brother had rented from Blockbuster and copied to a VHS tape, as well as one fan sub at the end that was like, I didn't even understand the concept of a fan sub at the time.
My name's Captain Spike, and I've been watching fan subs since 1987.
So actually, though, I should say, for those of you out there who aren't familiar with fan subs, basically a fan sub is when, you know, you have a Japanese show running. Technically, it could be any language show, but in this case, we're talking about anime. You have a Japanese show running. Basically, fans record it off broadcast and subtitle it themselves, as opposed to, you know, a production studio or an official licensor doing the work and releasing it in stores. Typically, back in the day, this was something that fans did for other fans, like, oh, hey, I'm studying Japanese, I can translate this, I'm going to do that, and then pass it on to my friends, and then they're going to make copies and pass those copies on to friends. They're going to pass copies on to their friends.
It's just so crazy to think about how it's changed thanks to technology.
Right? But what this ended up in is, for a lot of these early shows back in the old days, a lot of us, our first impressions of a show would be like a seventh generation fan-subbed bootleg. Well, I still remember, like, the first time I watched Fushigi Yugi, one of my all-time favorite series, some of the tapes that I had were so bad that I literally had to, like, start calling people that I didn't even know from, like, anime socials events that I met them at and be like, hey, do you have episode 43 to 47 of Fushigi Yugi? Because my copy is unwatchable.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. But anyway, so my good friend had this tape. It had it was like Dominion Tank Police, Fatal Fury, the video game adaptation, and Starlight Odin. Which, you know, this stuff, it was, like, mind-blowing. It was so different from any kind of show or live-action or anime that I had ever seen. It was just totally different. It blew my mind. But what really hooked me, and that's what got me interested in anime as an art form, but what really hooked me on the content was the first time I rented Vampire Hunter D from Blockbuster
Video. Oh, nice.
And, you know, I've always been a bit on the spooky side. I've always been, you know, more into swords and vampires and goth. And, you know, I'd already had a little bit of an appreciation for the artwork of Yoshitaka Amano from his work on the Final Fantasy series. And he had done the character designs and artwork for Vampire Hunter D. And so I saw this movie, and it really changed my perception of what animation could be. And I never really went back. From that point on, I have considered myself an anime fan through thick and thin.
So you could say that it'd be fair for us to conclude that you like the D.
That is an accurate statement. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, favorite...
It is classic.
It is. It's an absolute classic. It has a new edition coming out, new remaster on Blu-ray.
Oh, wow.
Coming out at the end of this month, I think. So we may talk about that here on the show after our next planned episode, which I think we're going to probably talk about Cowboy Bebop, but getting ahead of ourselves. My favorite show is Revolutionary Girl Utena. It is about a girl who wants to be a prince. She falls into a bizarre conspiracy in her school of sword fighting, and it sort of takes a look at, like, what it is to be a teenager, what it is to be, you know, a part of the system that doesn't feel like they belong, and sort of covers themes of, like, the ownership of self and really, like, taking control of your situation and not letting other people make choices for you and tell you what and who you are. And so it really speaks to me, like, basically nothing else. I'm super into it. It is definitely one we're going to be doing some episodes on here on the show, so please look forward to that. Slaggy, so we've talked a little bit about anime, but I want to talk a little bit about two other components of the anime fandom, particularly in North America, where, you know, if you're a fan of anime, you're probably also into Japanese music and manga. So let's talk a little bit about Japanese music. Who is your favorite Japanese musician, Saigi?
I'd probably have to say Asian Kung Fu Generation.
Oh, that is fantastic. Can you narrow it down to a specific song by them?
Probably Rewrite, which is one of the theme songs from Full Metal Alchemist.
Oh, man, that is such a great song. And, you know, Asian Kung Fu Generation is one of those bands that I think a lot of people get into them because of the anime songs they've done. But they've actually released several of their records in North America, starting with the 2004 release of Soul Thaw.
Yeah, and that's, like, such a great record. I mean,
and yeah, that whole record is great. I actually have a Japanese copy of that and an American copy, and I live for that record. Stuff like Siren, Kimito Machi Made, just some fantastic songs on that record.
Yeah, so, definitely. I mean, that was such a big revelation for me, I think, because, you know, I was familiar with, like, anime music and J-rock, J-pop before that. You know, I was a fan of Gackt always, and, you know, I would download anime music on Audio Galaxy, and I would download, like, the vocal image songs from Gundam Wing back when that was a thing.
Right.
And, like, Tenchi Muyo, like, Dimensions of Love and stuff, and, you know, I just make these, like, anime remixes, but, like, when I first heard Asian Kung Fu Generation, I was like, oh, snap, like, this is, like, the, you know, pop punk and emo music that I'm, like, totally into, like, at the time, you know, that was, like, what I was super into. I was like, wow, this is, like, hell of good. So, I think, you know, it kind of showed me that, like, you know, Japanese music can be more than just, like, anime. Although, you know, even, like, you know, a band like that, like, a lot of their stuff has been used for anime, so.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. For me, you know, the easy pick would be to say Utada Hikaru.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've been very fortunate in my life. I've gotten to see her perform live. But I'm actually going to sideskip that because I think it's a little inauthentic to say that. The band that got me into Japanese music in the way that you experienced with Asian Kung Fu Generation was actually Gackt's first big band, Malice Mizer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a big deal on the internet. You see a lot of people posting on YouTube, or back in the day, you know, they'd be posting these like 50 meg MPEG videos that were like the size of a postage stamp. And the one that I saw that really hooked me was Gekka no Yasokyoku, which, you know, the band is all like dressed up like characters out of Castlevania. It's really creepy.
I sense a theme here.
And gothic. Well, exactly. That was definitely me in the 90s, was into the creepy, the gothic. And that's what really, really attracted me to Malice Mizer. You know, I loved Gackt's voice. It was unlike anything else. The way that Malice Mizer, who is, you know, like a sub-form of metal music almost, they play with symphonic instruments and like little like music toy boxes to just create really unsettling sounds when they're on point. Like, I admit their bad songs are bad, but their good songs are so good. And that was the first band that I like literally ordered like an import VHS cassette tape of.
Oh wow.
Like, I would buy their tour videos, I would buy their music video collections, and it was just like this beacon for me. Like, people would come over to my place just to watch Malice Mizer stuff because no one else, you know, was importing this stuff, and I would have to make some crazy connections with random people at anime conventions to get my hands on this stuff, because it wasn't like the modern age where you load up Amazon and they have everything you need. Like, you had to network, you needed to make friends with like people who like were in touch with distributors overseas. But it was absolutely worth it. It was a fundamental like building block of who I am today, practically. And so I would have to cite Malice Mizer as my favorite, and my favorite song is Gekka no Yasokyoku.
All right.
Yeah, so let's wrap this conversation up. Our last little introductory question. I want to talk a little bit about manga. And Sagi, I know you read a little less manga than I do, but I know you
quite, quite a lot less.
Well, everyone, most people read a lot less than I do, but I'd still say you read more than most. So, who is your favorite mangaka? Which is to say, your favorite manga author.
I mean, I kind of have two answers here.
Give them both. I gave two music answers.
I would say that probably my favorite manga is Paradise Kiss, which
yes.
also is one of my favorite anime, and that is by Ayazawa-san, and you know, like, her art is just super gorgeous. Nana is also great both in manga and in anime form. So I would say that even though I haven't read all of her work, you know, that just her storytelling and her visual storytelling.
I was just going to ask, have you ever read or watched the anime adaptation of Gokinjo Monogatari?
No.
That's Neighborhood Stories, and it's almost like a predecessor story to Paradise Kiss.
Right, right.
I think you'd get a lot out of that. But anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Continue.
But anyways, what I was saying is that, you know, just her visual storytelling is pretty great. You know, Clamp has always been great, you know, and they had a huge impact on the manga and anime worlds. But I think even more so than Clamp probably would be Akira Toriyama-san. I mean, you know, just basically, like, the reason that Shonen Jump was a thing, you know, and, you know, just thinking of, you know, I think most people would probably associate him more with, you know, Dragon Ball or Dragon Ball Z, but, you know, he started out as a manga artist and, you know, really just really shaped the genre. And, you know, Chrono Trigger, he did character designs for that. So just really, you know, his impact is felt throughout multiple industries.
Oh, absolutely. Like, absolutely. And, you know, for me, I think it's funny because we sort of touch a little bit here on this one. For me, and I don't know if I would cite them as my favorite mangaka necessarily, would be Clamp. I don't know if I'd cite them as my favorite necessarily, but they were definitely, like, the influential ones that got me into manga in the first place.
Yeah, I remember a lot of my friends in high school were, like, all about the Clamp.
Oh, yeah. And I went to an anime club meeting in my high school my freshman year. And, you know, I was very fortunate. I went to school in the Bay Area. We had a lot of Japanese-speaking students, a lot of students who, like, literally came from Japan and had home videos of their own that we would watch untranslated, that we had Japanese language classes in our school. And so, you know, we'd all pass notes on, like, this is how I think this should translate. This is how I think this should translate. And, you know, it worked out really well. But my very first attendance at one of these meetings, or at one of these club meetings, was they were viewing Magic Knight Rare Earth,
aww,
which is a landmark series. And that manga was actually, like, I for me, like, the big thing that really hooked me on manga, it was being translated in North America in what Mixzine was it? Like, was that Tokyopop's, like, monthly shoujo book, Mixzine, I think?
Sounds right.
In fact, they might have even not... That might have even been before they were called Tokyopop. Either way, you know, they were running the Magic Knight Rayearth manga in this monthly periodical, and I just got hooked. I needed to know all the story once I started reading the manga after just watching the first episode of the anime unsubtitled, and just really hooked me. I started reading it, and even from there, you know, it was just like, I would prefer to read manga than watch anime, and that in a lot of ways... In a lot of ways, that's still true.
But this isn't manga buoy.
Well, bitch, we're getting there. But, you know, stuff that there is a manga and an anime, I prefer the manga. But I definitely think that anime as an art form is something that I enjoy more than manga generally. I definitely have never read a manga that has made me feel the way I felt the first time I watched Macross Plus, for example. You know, some of these landmark shows where the music, the anime... Like animation and character designs and mechanical designs and effects work and voice acting, when it just all comes together, I find it intensely powerful, and it's something I'm super into. My favorite mangaka, if I'm not going with Clamp, it would probably be accurate to say that it's probably Aizawa as well. Mm-hmm. A huge Paradise Kiss fan. I love it. That's another series that really speaks to me as an adult, honestly, has informed me in many ways. And I love Nana. I think Nana is a fantastic show. Definitely something, show and book, definitely something we'll be talking about more here in the future.
Indeed.
So that's kind of us in a nutshell. So I have expected you, Slaggy, to like... Do the Austin Powers. This is me in a nutshell. How did I get in this nutshell?
Ooh, this is Candy. We're having fun.
So with that, you know, I want to sort of get over to the main part of our discussion. I want to talk about Satoshi Kon, whom is generally considered, you know, one of the masters of the Japanese animation art form. Satoshi Kon was born on October 12th in 1963. And Satoshi Kon is interesting because, you know, he didn't just end up in animation. He actually, from childhood, wanted to be an animator. Several of his classmates as a child all ended up growing up to become mangaka and animators. And Kon-san, in fact, in college, actually made his debut as a manga artist and actually won quite a few awards for his 1984 release, Toriko. No relation to the Toriko that is currently running in Shonen Jump.
Right.
And after that, he actually found work as Katsuhiro Otomo-san's assistant. And you're probably familiar with Otomo-san from, like, Akira, which is obviously, you know, one of the biggest properties in the anime world.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, not really a surprise that he did eventually make it over to animation, where he scripted and co-produced the fifth episode of the original video animation, or OVA for short, of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure that was done in the early 90s. Not to be confused with the JoJo's Bizarre Adventure TV series that is currently running.
Right.
And is gigantic. That show is so popular now, it's nuts. And then, you know, in 1997, he began work on his directorial film debut, Perfect Blue. Perfect Blue, for me, is one of my very favorite films of all time. We are going to talk a little more in detail about it, but I want to sort of finish talking about his life before we dig into that. After Perfect Blue, he began working on an adaptation of the novel Paprika, but unfortunately the distribution company that he worked with Perfect Blue and with whom he was going to work with for Paprika, Rex Entertainment, they went out of business. So Kon immediately started working on his next project, sidetracked that, and started working on Millennium Actress.
Mm.
Millennium Actress is a superb film. It's one that I appreciate more and more every time I watch it,
yeah.
Actually. There's a lot mentally to chew on there, but something that runs through all of Kon's films, and this is something that I really like, there's always a focus on, like, humanity and how we connect to the world around us and how we impact the people around us. And, you know, that's really also at the core of his third work, which was the 2003 release of Tokyo Godfathers. You know, so, yeah, I know that you're a huge fan of Tokyo Godfathers, right?
That's actually one of the Kon films I've never seen.
For some reason, I thought you were super into that. Okay.
No, but I will talk about one of the films that we are talking about today is one of my favorite anime films of all time.
Is it the one we haven't gotten to yet?
No. Well, I mean, I do love that one. It's Millennium Actress.
Oh, okay, excellent. Well, Tokyo Godfathers was the most expensive work that Kon had done to date, but it was very popular worldwide. Definitely made Satoshi Kon a name. I was actually super into Satoshi Kon because I saw the North American premiere of Perfect Blue at Anime Expo in, oh gosh, I mean, it must have been like 98 or something. And it was, it blew me away.
Is that
it
when
so
you
intense.
Wore a sheet as Gundo Ikari into DDR?
Yeah, I got up to some cosplay shenanigans, including dressing up as a sheet ghost, dressed up as Gendo Ikari underneath. Anyway.
DDR.
We will talk about cosplay someday, and I will talk about all of these adventures. Kon then, in 2004, did a 13-episode TV series, Paranoia Agent. And this is, again, a real focus on, you know, how our internal realities connect to our external realities, sort of how we treat each other and what that says about us as individuals, how we interact and relate to society and fit in or don't. You know, this was apparently really a collection of ideas that he had had for his other films that he wasn't really able to work in. And so he put them together in Paranoia Agent. Then, finally, after years and years of trying to get it made, in 2006, Paprika was finally ready for primetime. This is one of my very favorite movies. You're probably familiar with some of the concepts from it, which we'll talk about a little later. It's focused around a form of psychotherapy that utilizes, like, going into dreams to treat patients. This film was actually optioned by the film director who made Inception.
I was going to say.
Because, you know, some of the concepts were so close between Inception and Paprika that they actually had needed permission in order to use some of these ideas. They were so close. And I'm sorry, that was Christopher Nolan.
Oh, right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, and then after that, Kon-san went back to working on a smaller project. He created a 2007 NHK television production for Anikura 15. That short is called Ohio. And immediately after that, he actually began work on what was to be his next film, which was called Dreaming Machine. But unfortunately, in May 2010, Satoshi Kon was diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer. His doctors gave him a half a year to live, and Kon decided not to make a big deal out of his sickness. He just spent the rest of his life at home, enjoying his life with his family. And then, you know, he wrote a very heartfelt message saying goodbye to his fans that was uploaded to his personal blog upon his death.
Yeah, that was a tough day.
That was a really tough day. I was quite devastated. I've been a big fan of this artist for many, many years, and it still is something that I don't like to think about a whole lot. But, you know, either way, I know that isn't how he would want to be remembered. He'd want to be remembered for the humanity of his work and the quality, exceptional quality of his work. And fortunately, he left us with quite an oeuvre to dissect. So Dreaming Machine supposedly will be finished someday by the production staff that he was working with. I eagerly await that day. And until then, let's talk a little bit about his work. Slaggy, with 1998's release of Perfect Blue, have you seen Perfect Blue now?
Oh, yeah.
When did you see it for the first time?
You know, I want to say it was in the early 2000s. I remember, you know, I was probably like a junior or senior in high school, and I just remember my friends and I, because at that point I had, you know, found a group of friends who were into, like, games and anime and stuff. So, you know, I'd found my people. And I just remember, I remember it being like a big deal because it was like super adult, you know, and we were like 17 or whatever. It's like, you know, there are very mature themes, and, you know, it's as we're going to talk about, you know, it is pretty intense. So I just remember being like, oh, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was in high school the first time I saw this movie. I probably shouldn't have seen it, to be quite honest. It's a very intense and unsettling film. But I even to this day, it is to me the perfect example of why anime needs to be viewed as an art form rather than as just like a genre. Because, you know, this is a psychological thriller slash horror film. It's based on a novel. It's basically about a Japanese pop idol who decides to leave her idol group. And as soon as she announces that she's leaving, she begins noticing that she has a stalker who is clearly hostile towards her, starts calling her names, starts calling her a traitor. And things just get really intense as he stalks her more and more. She is trying to work on non-like idol/pop music productions. She gets on the set of like an adult thriller film that has like a rape scene in it. And as she's being stalked and her nerves let go more, she begins to really struggle with like even filming this scene. And she begins to hallucinate. And it's actually very, very similar. Funny enough, you know, this actually reminds me, Darren Aronofsky had to license this film out.
Oh, really?
Due to its similarities to the film Black Swan. So if what I'm talking about right now is like, oh, hey, she's on set and begins to hallucinate because she can't differentiate reality from like this intense situation created by aggressive peers. If that sounds familiar, that's because, again, this movie was very similar to a Hollywood movie that came years later.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, that's a thing that happens. So anyway, this film is incredibly intense. I don't want to go into spoilers beyond what we've already set up, because I definitely think that this is one that people should see themselves. But Slaggy, I want to talk about, how did this movie impact you at the time when you first saw it?
I mean, shit. I mean, this was probably the first like adult anime I had seen, so I think it was really transformative in that way, you know, because, I mean, even things that were, you know, like PG-13-ish, like Trigun, or even things as intense as Evangelion can be, you know, this is, like, you know, straight-up R-rated material, and I think it definitely, for me, expanded my view of what this art form could accomplish, you know?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny to me because I recall at the time, particularly in North America, where this film actually got a limited theatrical release, a lot of critics were, you know, talking about how this shouldn't have been done as animation. It should have been a live action film because the themes were too heavy for animation. And, you know, the funny thing is a lot of film theorists and critics have really connected this to almost being a film on like the level of Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah.
And it's funny because to me, some of the more surreal imagery, some of the uses of colors and stuff, some of the stuff that really makes this film pop and work, it would almost be lost in a live action setting, I feel.
Yeah, and it was actually going to start out at live action, wasn't it?
That has been my understanding, but, you know, Satoshi Kon himself...
Someone else went and made a live action adaptation of the novel.
Well, you know, Satoshi Kon himself has always stated that he thought the film worked better and was more interesting as animation, and that he stood by his choice to do it as animation. And I have always very strongly agreed with this. I have always really strongly felt like Perfect Blue is better as animation than it would have been as a live-action film. You know, the big core themes of this movie ultimately are, you know, about sort of your perception of reality around you, your perception of identity, and your perception of other people's pictures of you, the way other people view your identity. And, you know, there's also has been a lot of feminist discussion about this film because,
oh, yeah,
you know, you do ultimately have, you know, a woman who is being stalked by a man in contemporary Japan, which, you know, is definitely used as critique to sort of consumer society in a lot of ways, and the way that sort of fame eats up you know, famous people and discards them. There's this film, it just, it has so much going on and there's so much to unpack.
You know, when we were researching for this episode, I had never known that Madonna used some clips from Perfect Blue to be part of her What It Feels Like for a Girl video interlude. Like, you know, that was playing in the background when she was performing the song or whatever. And I didn't realize that, but, you know, Madonna, you get someone with, you know, very strong, you know, feminist leanings and, you know, also someone very savvy, you know, in the type of media that she uses. So, like, I'm not surprised, but I'd never known that.
Excellent. Well, let's move forward here. We can talk about this more at some point in the future. But why don't you talk, Saigi, about Millennium Actress? I know this is your favorite. So, you know, because you just told me. So why don't you break this one down for us?
All right, well, Millennium Actress was released in 2001, and it was animated by Madhouse, you know, a very popular animation studio that I'm sure we'll be talking about many, many times on the show.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to point out Madhouse also did the animation work on Perfect Blue.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure of that. Anyway, you know, it's about a movie studio is getting torn down, and so there's a TV interviewer who wants to interview its reclusive famous star. Her name is Chiyoko Fujiwara-san, and so basically it's kind of like, you know, a documentary with, you know, a very reclusive, faded actress, but, like, you know, they revisit her memories of film and, like, you know, just the different types of genres of film that she did and, you know, the different eras of her life, and it's really beautifully done because, you know, it incorporates, like, elements of her and the interviewer and his assistant, like, actually being drawn into the actual films that she starred in, and, you know, just kind of how the events of those films mirrored events in her own life. So it's just, it's so beautifully done. The ending is one of the most poignant endings. I don't want to spoil it, but probably one of the most poignant endings of any sort of film I've ever seen, animated or live action. And just really, just a beautiful work of art.
Excellent, excellent. And what I certainly agree with those statements, but what sort of themes does this movie sort of dissect and get into that for you really clicked, that really drew you into it?
I mean, it's just really, you know, similar to what you said, you know, about Chiyoko's own real life, you know, and how that was kind of mirrored by her reality, the realities that were in her films, you know? So just kind of like the intermingling of her real identity and the identities that she was assuming. But definitely, I think a lot more in a more heartfelt way than we saw in Perfect Blue, which, you know, is for more of the psychological thriller effect.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and I think that Millennium Actress is one of those films where, you know, if you're explaining it, it sounds a little twee. It doesn't sound like there's a lot of meat on that bone, but it is just such an emotional experience. The ending is just, it's absolutely heartfelt and pitch perfect.
Yeah.
In how that story concludes. And that's definitely one that I would highly recommend to people who are unfamiliar with Satoshi Kon's works. Millennium Actress, to me, is the perfect entry point into this fantastic director's oeuvre.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, the funny thing is that it was contemporaneous with Spirited Away. And I actually saw this the first time because this shows you, you know, how long ago it was. At my local Blockbuster store, they had a little, like, setup where they're like, if you like Spirited Away, try this, or whatever. And so I remember renting it, and it was interesting. I actually rented it, and my mother and I watched it together, and she really enjoyed it, too, which was super interesting because, you know, none of my family ever really had any interest in anime. So the fact that, I mean, aside from Studio Ghibli, but, you know.
I think the only anime my mom ever watched was an episode of Tenchi Universe. And she was just like, can we please turn this off? Oh, you know what? You know what, though? I say that, but she actually did watch the first Ghost in the Shell movie, and she didn't really understand it, but she really enjoyed the visuals.
That's cool. It's another great film, but yeah, so it was really interesting because, you know, aside from the works of, like, Miyazaki, that my family had, like, no interest in anime, so, like, that was really interesting to see, like, that the appeal of this film, and I would argue all of Satoshi Kon's films, like, you know, to say, oh, it's anime, Japanime, you know, that's just, like, you know, limiting what it really is. Which I think is really true for saying, oh, that's just an anime. It's just an anime, you know, like, so, you know, definitely, I think that even if you're like, I'm just listening to this because of Game Buoy, but I trust y'all. Give it a shot.
Yeah, absolutely. Next up, we have Tokyo Godfathers, which in many ways is probably the most well-known of Satoshi Kon's works in North America. We're probably going to say the least about this one. It's actually my least favorite of his works, but I do like it. Slaggy, as we discussed, hasn't seen it to date, so I'm going to actually remedy that this week because I think that's the appropriate thing to do. This was released in 2003, and it's basically, it takes place on Christmas Eve in present-day Tokyo, where three homeless people, one of whom is a middle-aged alcoholic, one of whom is a trans woman who was previously a drag queen, and one who is a younger runaway girl.
Okay, so it's Rent, but the anime version.
Ah! Well, basically, you know, they find a newborn baby while looking through the garbage, dumpster diving for food. And basically, there's like a bag with the baby, no name for the baby, but a note asking the people who find her to please take care of her. But there are a few other things in the bag as well that lead this unlikely trio to try to find whose baby this is. Like, this baby gonna die. We are homeless people. We cannot take care of it. We need to find this baby's parents. And it's just all about coincidences and the human experience and sort of how we're all ultimately reliant on one another to, you know, get through life. How ultimately, if we don't work together as a community to help each other out and prop each other up, ultimately none of us are going to make it. And, you know, obviously part of the point is that in a very real way, none of us does make it. You know, we all meet our end at someday. So it's very much a human experience movie. I would overall call it generally a feel-good movie. I think that's why it connected to people. I think that people really connect with these stories about family and love and longing and ultimately, you know, forgiveness. I think that resonates with people. And this movie, to me, is a really easy entry point into Colm's work. It's certainly a fantastic movie. It's just, you know, this is an A-, where the rests are A+. It is really, you know, when I sound less enthused about this,
it's a little more mainstream.
It is. And it takes fewer risks than his other work, which...
Yeah, because I wouldn't hesitate to call most of his work, like, art house sort of...
Oh, absolutely. The vast majority of his work is art house pieces.
Like the type of thing that you would expect getting a Criterion Collection release, which I'm surprised that they haven't considered releasing some.
If not for Paprika and Perfect Blue, if nothing else. It's insane to me that those two films haven't gotten the Criterion treatment, frankly, because they are culturally and socially relevant films. So let's move on and talk about Paprika. But I do want to remark Tokyo Godfathers again, animation done by Madhouse. It's a beautiful film. Great use of the color palette to set the mood. Fantastic art design. Character designs are a little strange, but work really well within the context of how the story is being presented. But Paprika is to me such a phenomenal film. Absolutely could not possibly have been done as a live action piece. This film is, as we said earlier, about a research psychologist using a device to permit therapists to enter the dreams of their patients to help them out. It's just a weird premise, but the movie it's really powerful. It has a lot to say again about sort of where you end and where your personality begins and sort of the way that you see the world around you. The way that you perceive, you know, other people and the way they perceive you. It's just, to me, it sucks that this is Colm's last film to date, but it really, to me, brings together all of the pieces of his other films. Sort of how we interact with each other, how we rely on each other, how we connect with the world around us, how we see the world around us, how we are affected by how we are seen. It just all really comes together here. Saigi, I know that you have strong feelings about Paprika. When was the first time you saw it?
So the first time I saw Paprika was with you, because at that point, I had met you, and so I think it was probably a couple years after its initial release, but it would have been over here at the, before it was known as the SS Anime Buoy, or the SS Game Buoy, over here at the apartment, it was just a really, really wonderful film. I mean, just masterful.
You know, this movie is notable. It has an amazing score by Susumu Hirasawa-san. It's notable for being the first film to have a soundtrack with vocals by a Vocaloid.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
You might be familiar with Hirasawa-san's other work. Did the score to Paranoia Agent, did the score for the Berserk animation, did the score for, you know, the Berserk games, soundtracks to a few other, like, sort of lower key anime, nothing like super incredibly big, but overall just a really solid selection of music, including in fact, actually, he also did the music for Millennium Actress. Both Millennium Actress and Paprika both have scenes where Hirasawa-san's music is synced to the animation in such a way to, like, give it more punch.
It's so good.
And the way that some of the scenes in Millennium Actress sync sync to the music is just phenomenal. It's one of those things where you look at it and it's like in live action, you could never get everything synced so perfectly to this music. But in animation, you know, it's a lot easier to do that, and you can end up with just a perfect presentation where you have almost like a real synthesic effect of the music and the visuals. Feeling now, like the same experience.
Now, were you saying that for both Millennium Actress and Paprika?
I was, because, you know, Millennium Actress has there's one key sequence in Millennium Actress I'm right. thinking of while I say that. And then I think about Paprika, and Paprika expands it by having several sequences like that. There are several sequences in Paprika where the use of colors, the use of imagery, the use of shapes, the use of sound, where everything just unites to create like a perfect sequence where, you know, it sticks with you years after watching it. Years later, you're into it. I have used Paprika to get people into anime. I've converted people into anime fans using Paprika because it is just such an amazing experience that could not have been done in any other medium. And to me, if you're okay with experimental pieces, this could be a really great entry point. But again, you know, like Saigi was saying, this is fundamentally an art house piece. It is not mainstream. It is not easy to get into, but if you give it the attention and effort to follow it and watch it and understand it, it will pay you back in dividends.
Yeah, and this is one that, although maybe not as popular or well-known as Tokyo Godfathers, as critically, you know, acclaimed.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I remember Elijah Wood once said that it was, like, one of his favorite films of all time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Quite a few well-known name actors in Hollywood cite the various works of Satoshi Kon as among their favorite. And it's really easy to see, as you watch these movies, as you experience these movies, it's just, these are the kinds of films that sit with you for the rest of your life, really. And that's really, to me, why I wanted to start this podcast talking about this amazing artist who, to me, really showed why anime as an art form is unlike anything else. It's top-notch. This film is top-notch science fiction. It doesn't have, you know, giant robots, alien worlds. This is
right.
a comet that's been made by many people, and I'm certainly not original in saying so, but it's just such an intense film. It is so touching and beautiful. I have never shown this film to someone and had them come out lukewarm on it. It's just always an eye-opener to be like, wow, this is art. This is nuts. So, Slaggy, do you have anything to add to Paprika? Came out in 2006, animated by Madhouse.
Now, just that it's, you know, amazing. And I mean, I would say that all of his films really have held up well in our timeless, but especially Paprika, you know, just like...
Paprika still feels like something that was made tomorrow.
Yeah, like Paprika, like... almost feels like it could have been made at any point, you know, just one of those, like, timeless, like, I would say it's up there with, like, something like Metropolis, you know?
The anime or the Fritz Lang film?
The Fritz Lang film, but there is an, yes, there is an anime Metropolis too, but, you know.
But yeah, it's exactly why the Fritz Lang film Metropolis is so well loved, because even still, it feels like such a modern take on some concepts.
Right.
And I would say all of Kon's oeuvre feels that way to some degree, possibly exempting Perfect Blue, which definitely feels like it was born out of that late 90s, early 2000s sort of pop obsession era. But
Sexploitation.
Oh, I don't like that word at all. But yeah, as you say, Slaggy, Paprika is like the height of that. It is just an amazing film. I can't speak highly enough of it. If you're listening to this show, if you're interested in the kinds of stuff we're going to talk about, I think you should definitely check Paprika out. Do you have anything else to add, Slaggy?
Not that I can think of.
All right, well, let's wrap this up by just, why don't you tell me a little bit about your thoughts on Satoshi Kon writ large?
I feel like he was a great first episode topic for us because, you know, over on Game Buoy, we're trying to talk about, you know, games that maybe aren't on your radar but most definitely should be. And I would say that Satoshi Kon is one of those directors in anime that, you know, you maybe have heard of or, you know, there's some familiarity, but I feel like a lot of people, you know, will be like, oh, anime, Miyazaki, you know, who, of course, is also a visionary. But, you know, I feel like Satoshi Kon has an equally impressive and, you know, amazing roster of films under his belt, too. So
excellent. Excellent. Yeah. And I would largely agree to that in a lot of ways. When I hear that people are interested in anime and they haven't heard of Kon's work, it's just like, okay, well, Kon was a visionary, and I think that you, if you're interested in this art form, you need to check his work out, because it's to me, it's the pinnacle of what the art can be. Real talk.
Indeed.
All right, well, let's move forward a little bit with whatcha watching.
I said, hey, what's going on?
So this week, I have been watching a currently running anime series called Gate. Gate is about a extra-dimensional invasion of, like, fantasy, like, soldiers and elves and dragons into modern-day Japan. Modern-day Japan, though, has tanks and guns, and actually withstands the invasion pretty easily, and ends up, like, counter-invading with a militaristic otaku sort of as the head of their campaign into this other world. And so you have, you know, this anime nerd who is going into this other world, and he has a couple of colleagues who are also otaku, and they're, like, going into this world, like, oh my god, do you think there are going to be catgirls there? So it's played for jokes, but it's still also played as a semi-serious fantasy film, or series. So I'm just a few episodes in so far. I guess 6 have aired to date, maybe 8, something that. But it's pretty good. I'm enjoying it, and I will let you know what I'm thinking next episode. I'll probably
I assume you're watching it on Crunchyroll?
I am watching it on Crunchyroll, yeah. What about you, Slaggy? What are you watching?
Well, this week specifically, I haven't been watching any anime, but so this answer is going to be a little bit of a cheat. I've been watching Steven Universe, which is not anime. It's, you know, a Western-produced cartoon, but there are definitely a lot of overt anime influences, so that's been a lot of fun, and definitely seeing the show take a more serious tone, which is, you know, I would argue that things, particularly over on Cartoon Network, which has really done a lot to foster, you know, these more... To foster these more, you know, serious, or, you know, not always serious, but... more like a narrative arc based, or, you know,
serial,
yeah, and you know, keeping in mind adult audiences too, which I mean, cartoons have always done it to a certain degree forever, but so I mean, I've definitely been enjoying that. But in terms of anime, two of the recent ones that I've been catching up on, which were from last season, or, you know, within the past couple of seasons, because, you know, anime does, you know, 4 seasons a year, is Yuki Yuna is a Hero.
Oh, I love that show.
And Yamada-kun and the Seven Witches, which, you know, these are English translated titles, but...
I'll be honest, I thought you were going to talk about Kill la Kill in this space.
Oh, yeah, I mean, but that was like a month ago that I finished Kill la Kill, so I guess that's worth talking about. I mean, definitely.
Okay, we'll... but talk about it. Let's go. What are these shows about? What do you think about them?
Well, really quickly, Kill la Kill is about a girl with a talking school uniform who goes to battle the upper ranks of her high school, and... all types of drama involving fashion happens.
You make it sound so like slice of life, Ayazawa, Paradise Kiss, fashion style. It is about so much more than that.
It's basically like Evangelion, but with magical school uniforms.
Fair.
Yuki Yuna as a Hero is about a group of middle school girls who... are destined to save this magic realm called the Vertex, and they have, like, magical cell phone transformations, and it sounds way sillier and way more moe than, you know, than it actually is. And so I'm looking forward to see how it plays out, because it looks like it could really subvert a lot of the magical girl tropes, which is what I always like.
And when you say it like that, it sounds like Madoka Magica.
I don't know if it's going to quite reach the level of Madoka Magica, but, you know,
Which is probably my second favorite anime series of all time.
Yeah, not much can top Madoka Magica. And Yamada-kun and the Seven Witches is about a kind of a bad boy high school delinquent who ends up accidentally falling down the stairs with this really shy girl. And when they knocked into each other, they accidentally kissed and switched bodies. And so basically it's about, you know, this character Yamada-kun who has magical kissing powers. And again, sounds like it would be a lot more like a harem sort of anime, but it's actually really clever and cute. And there are some boy-on-boy kisses, kind of mostly played for laughs, but, you know, I always appreciate a little bit of yaoi in there.
All right. Well, unless you have anything else to talk about, this is typically where we'd go into our social links, but since we haven't tweeted out at you guys at animebui.org with the .org spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
With the .org spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
We're just going to move straight over to our exit lewd. Slaggy, why don't you handle those solicitations?
We love your feedback. As of recording this, we don't yet have an iTunes feed because
we don't exist yet.
This podcast is currently existing for the first time. Talk about a mindfuck sort of anime theme. We don't exist yet, but when you hear this, we will have existed. But
I like that.
When you hear this, we will have an iTunes. And so we appreciate your ratings and reviews, if that's your sort of thing. We like your Facebook likes. We have a Facebook, or will, by the time that we post this episode. And we effing love Twitter.
We effing love Twitter.
We actually do already, as of recording, have a Twitter account.
And that's animebui.org with the .org spelled out, D-O-T-O-R-G.
It is. You can mail us at mailbui@animebui.org.
Mailbui@animebui.org.
And, of course, you can catch our episodes all over at our home base, animebui.org.
Animebui.org.
And we will also be trying to get a Stitcher Radio as well, so probably by the time you hear this.
Excellent, excellent.
Expect the next episode to have a better social media shout-out.
Woohoo! I look forward to it. In the meantime, though, you know, you can check out our other show, GameBui.org.
GameBui.org.
You can, of course, find that over at GameBui.org.
At GameBui.org, with the .org spelled out, D-O-T-O-R-G.
Well, that's the Twitter, and, you know, the website is just GameBui.org.
Yep, and we've been going, this is our fourth year now.
Yep,
well into our fourth year.
We're about to record our episode Ninty, so
yeah,
please look forward to that.
Yeah, 19th
episode. We also want to shout out to Reading is Fundamental, which is Slagkick's show about RuPaul's Drag Race, as well as the Starboard Power Coupling podcast, the Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail. And last but certainly not least, Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional wrestling podcast for the common man. Slaggy, you should take us somewhere.
Well, first I'd like to say that if you have any anime-themed podcasts, we'd love to hear them. I've got to admit that, you know, my podcasting radar has definitely been tuned into gaming podcasts because, you know, that was the mothership of the SS Game Buoy. But if you have a gaming, if you have an anime or Japanese manga, if you have an anime or otherwise, you know, Japanese culture, pop culture podcast or something like that, please shout us out. Please let us know and we'll be sure to shout you out. But otherwise, I'd like to give my regular shout-outs that you can hear over on GameBui.org.
GameBui.org.
And that starts with the hunty bunch of gay gaming podcasts, including Game Bar, the gay video game prairie home companion, Koopa Club, an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist, the award from their mothers, and the Joystick Jockeys, two LGBTQ gamers who love games and love talking about them. I'd like to also shout out to the Game Over Takeover podcast, your one-stop shop to go to for geekery galore. And over on the Voice of Geeks Network, you can hear great podcasts, including Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice, Girls Gone WoW, where you can get a female's perspective on the world's most popular MMO, and Horde House, a place for all things online gaming, but never too seriously, and actually currently on hiatus.
Boo!
And last but certainly not least, La Palanca Podcast, a podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español.
Excellent.
I'm sorry if I forgot one of my usuals. It is literally 100 degrees aboard the SS Game Buoy right now.
Yeah. We actually just hit 102, so yay! Thank you for spending this warm Sunday afternoon with us. I know it's a lot to ask that you guys spend even more time listening to our nerdy asses, but we really appreciate all of you. I hope you've had as much fun listening to this as we have talking to you, and we hope to get back to you in the near future. But until then, keep watching, Keep Thinking, and see you, Space Cowboy.
That's next episode.
Mic check, mic check. Oh, even that was a little loud. Mic check, mic check, mic check.
Mic crotch, mic crotch, mic crotch.
Already perfect. Perfect. If you could keep that volume, that would be great.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Ahoy, mateys.
Including Game Bar, the podcast that fills your brain...